In the sort of question and answer session this afternoon, one of the things that we were talking about was allusions and the way in which, if one comes out of a particular culture and tradition, one's allusions are not necessarily going to find a universal resonance, and that it is increasingly difficult at this particular period in American history, I think, for writers of my generation, and perhaps particularly for someone who didn't even start in America, but came here after I was married, grew up in England, to particularly difficult to count on one's readers knowing the same things that one knows and which one used to sort of take for granted were common knowledge, because that whole range of common knowledge, there is so much input in our lives now, and I suppose there will be more and more. It's very confusing. Nobody can know it all, and if Western culture and its traditions are what one comes out of, one has to use those allusions, but they are they more and more seem to need footnoting. Well, this poem, I suppose, is in a way an example of that, because this poem talks about John Ruskin, and it quotes a lot from Ruskin. So I hope it wouldn't be inaccessible to somebody that knew nothing about Ruskin. I hope it sort of makes itself reasonably accessible. But on the other hand, if you did know something about Ruskin, it would have a context that would give it a different kind of resonance. It also talks about John Muir, and I think one can, at the moment, count on the fact that people who read poetry and go to poetry readings also care about the wilderness and about ecology, and therefore they would know who John Muir is. All the quotes in here are from Ruskin. It's called The Faithful Lover. Play with a few decades, shift them. Try to imagine Ruskin in the New World, walking with John Muir in the wilderness. He whose enraptured first sight of the Alps transformed him that meek Protestant Sunday when he and Mama and Papa and dull Cousin Mary were patiently waiting the secular week's beginning before attempting the sights, but all unawares came face to face with the sublime, unmistakably not clouds, surpassing all that engravings had promised, floating west of Schaffhausen, sharp, tinged with rose, far into blue, suddenly beyond. Changed him from docile prig, poor child, he was 14 and knew so much and so little, to a man of passion, whatever his failings. Imagine him in Yosemite. Would loyalties already divided, rock simple or rock wrought, strata of mountains, strata of human craft, tools of geology or tools of art, have split him? Would wilderness legends unknown, or if known, offering no toehold for his mind's expectant footing, have swept him wholly into its torrents of non-human grandeur? Or wouldn't art have pulled him back in the end to layered history felt in the bones, even geology a fraction of that insistence, loved for its poetry of form, color, textures, not as a scientist loves it? Back to where human hands created rich tessellations, or the shadowy Rialto threw its colossal curve slowly forth, that strange curve so delicate, so adamantine, strong as a mountain cavern, graceful as a bow just bent. Back to where nature, even the Alps, still so remote, unsung through so many centuries, lay in the net or nest of perception, seen, then re-seen, recognized, wrought in myth.